it's certainly a very fancy institute here. Can everyone hear me okay? Today I'm going to be talking about some work that I did with Philip Argyris and Mohammed Erlaghi, who is a student. They're both at Cincinnati. And we were basically studying this idea that a number of people here have helped originate, and that is being able to compute jet quenching from the ADS-CFP correspondence. And we found that we're a bit confused about the number of points, and we think that this might reflect some problems, not necessarily in the prescription that is used for computing the jet quenching parameter, but more in the general interpretation of the ADS-CFP correspondence at finite temperature. This is based on a preprint that's already out, as well as some work in progress. Not sure how far I can go. So before I begin, I noted an interesting remark that was recently printed in the Esquire that took place in the late night hours of the Jane Bond bar. And what I hope is that this marvelous idea of getting jet quenching parameter from string theory might be a nice counterexample. So, this is a rendition of the Rick firewall, and it's believed to currently, as of April 2005, the consensus of the four groups at Rick is that this firewall is actually a strongly coupled Bok gluon liquid rather than the expected weakly coupled gas. And so this paves the way to trying to use the ADS-CFT correspondence to understand the properties of this fireball. And a number of people, including Alex Bouchel and Andre Serinets, Pavel Kovtun, I don't think I've missed anyone who's here, initiated the program. Not only the program for computing hydrodynamics properties, but also transport properties, namely the energy loss of quarks as they plow through this firewall. So at around the same time, four papers came out attempting, in two or three different procedures, attempting to compute these transport properties. And so that's what I'll be discussing today. So the outline of my talk is first to discuss some ambiguities, as I mentioned, in finding the correspondence at finite temperature. And then we'll see how these ambiguities might carry over to the extraction of both the friction coefficient as well as the jet quenching parameter. And we'll see that in the ultra-relativistic regime, the procedures that have been proposed for extracting these two quantities are rather different. So first, ambiguities of ADS-CFP at finite temperature. So according to Malacena, for the zero temperature case, the four-dimensional n equals 4 super Young-Mills theory is equated with type 2b string theory on an ADS5 cross S5 factor. This is for large number of colors and for large curved coupling. So an example of how this can be applied is for quarks in ADS-CFG. Maybe I shouldn't call them quarks yet. We can see. So suppose you have a probe D7 grain, and it basically lives in the ADS-5 part of the space and is wrapped around an S3 that lies within the S5 part. And it goes down to some minimum radius R7. So suppose you then attach a string where two points of this, the two endpoints end on the probe grain. Then from the point of view of the dual gauge theory, these two endpoints can be interpreted as particles, depending on their behavior, as quarks. And they have a mass that's proportional to this minimal radius of the probe grain. So Ray and Yi, as well as Malacena, put out the proposal that in the limit, first of all, I should say they work in the limit where R7 goes off to infinity, which means you no longer have actual dynamical quarks. But you know, that's a starting point, and then you know one can correct that. So basically, what they proposed was you can take a the Wilson loop of the dual gauge theory and equate that with e to the I s, where for s they use the Nambu-Goto string action. And the sigma coordinates are the world volume coordinates, and the x nus are the space-time coordinates. And so if you do this for the local, the metric for ADS5 in the Poincaré patch, you can get the energy of the string. Oh, I should probably also emphasize, so there's no movement in the system, right? It's a bit misleading, perhaps, the way I drew it, but you know, this horizontal direction is time. So you can extract the energy of the system from the action. And from the equations of motion, you can enforce the boundary condition that the endpoints are a distance L apart, and then you can see how the energy is related to L. And you end up getting a Coulombic type interaction. And this is perhaps what you'd expect, since you're at the conformal fixed point of the theory. So it's certainly you know, not confined to quarks, but it's the starting point. So very soon after that, a number of people studied how to turn on a temperature, a finite temperature in the theory, which basically means you add a black hole in the supergravity boundary. And what they find is that this energy is corrected by the presence of the temperature. However, as we'll see in a moment, the volume of C cannot actually be determined. So why is that? Well, so they use the ADS5 black hole metric. And so for instead of writing the mass of the black hole, I just expressed it in terms of the temperature, T. And large R is the effective length scale of the ADS space. So at least naively, one would think that the length scale and time intervals of these two theories, supergravity and the gauge theory, can be related as follows. The length scale of each theory can be set equal. And the time scale, there's a factor which depends on this black hole F evaluated, you know, depending on where the D7 grain minimal radius is. But it turns out that one could always add a scaling to this identification. And by you know, dimensions, you'd expect that the scaling would depend not only on the coupling constant, but also on the ratio of the minimal radius R7 to temperature R squared. So it seems to be a bit of a problem, I think, how one would actually compute this scaling G factor. It seems that one would essentially have to do some distance-dependent calculation.
So is this the issue that you need to regularize, that you need to UV regularize the area on the surface, or is it a different question?
I think it's a different question.
Okay, so imagine you have some regularization for the UV regularization. Why can't you just, you know, compute the area?
I think Justin's point is that so you have a heat series parameters and you have a supergravity parameters. How exactly do you map it? It's not.
Even if it is infinitely massive, it doesn't prove that.
Well, I think that's what you are trying to say. It's not exactly clear how we, in his particular example, how you relate distances from a gauge series to.
Even if it's infinitely massive.
So if you think there is a, well, in an infinitely massive quark, I think that ratio goes to, you know, it will be some number. So in that case, I think analytically you should be able to do sort of two leading order, yeah, for infinitely massive one, yes.
So, right, but for the general mass of the quark, and for general temperature, you know, I think it's kind of an open question how to do this. And it seems that in order to do this, one would have to calculate some sort of distance-dependent correlation function in the strongly coupled gauge theory, and then compare that to supergravity. So now I'd like to talk a bit about the string configurations and their properties in the presence of this black hole. So it turns out that as you increase the distance between the string endpoints, the string is going to probe further and further into the towards the black hole. But after a certain distance, it turns out that the string is going to break apart into two disconnected strings. So in essence, what this is telling us is that there's a critical distance L sub C, at which there's complete screening between the quark and the anti-quark pair. And this was first noticed back in 98 by a number of people. And they found that this screening length, L sub C, is approximately 0.4 of the black hole temperature. But again, there's an ambiguity as to what exactly this screening length is in the gauge theory based on this scaling parameter.
So you were saying that there is, because there was this coefficient C, and you were saying that we could not compute it?
Right.
But in principle, you should be able to compute it, you know, for what basically Pavel kept asking, right?
Yeah,
at least two leading, in particular for infinite mass, you don't have, you know, there is only temperature, basically. So can you compute what C is in that case?
So, yeah, that's true. Probably as a perturbation.
Right, so there will be, you should probably develop some sort of high temperature perturbation based on, you know, infinite temperature value of C. But you're not saying. But so that number was, there is a value for that number, right?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, but I mean, infinitely massive quark is precisely what determines the Wilson loop for you, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, because, I mean, the procedure for computing Wilson loop is
precisely infinitely massive.
So the procedure for computing the potential between two infinite quarks is well.
And the Wilson loop. Yeah, I agree. And I think even the leading order correction, the first order correction in the, you know, in the high temperature, it's also unambiguously computed. Exactly the same story comes up with mass deformations.
So it turns out that there are actually two strings of this type in this background. And this was discussed by Chernikov, Garcia, and Grifosa. This year. So there's a shorter string, and then there's a long string that, well, if it's static, then it actually dips down and touches the black hole horizon. However, it turns out that this long string is actually unstable, and this will ultimately decay, I shouldn't say ultimately, into the short string.
Wait, so this is main cause, there's no predictor, so
So right now this is Minkowski, although in the Euclidean picture there's a similar situation as well. For the Minkowski case, you can see that the long string is unstable because this was done by Fries, collaborators at Princeton. So basically what they did was they did perturbations around this background, and then they found that this is a tachyonic mode. For the Euclidean, you can do an energy analysis, and then again you find that the favorable state is the short string. So suppose you have a moving string, moving at constant velocity in this background, then you can choose an embedding such that a direction in the world volume, orthogonal to the movement, is given by the world sheet space-like direction, sigma. And then the radius, radial direction, is some function of the sigma. And so this embedding is for the case in which the movement is in the direction perpendicular to the string endpoint separation. So then you would have boundary conditions. Suppose the separation is a distance L, then the boundary conditions, of course, are at the endpoints and not the probe ring. And so you can then get an equation of motion, and you can take the first integral of that. We're getting this equation, and you'll notice that there's a reality condition on R to be greater than a certain value, and this value is always greater than the radius of the event horizon. So the string, whenever there's motion, will never actually reach the event horizon.
What is this equation A?
So that's an integration parameter, and you can relate that to L numerically. And the interesting thing is you find that for a given L, there's actually two values of A. So that's the long string and the short string.
So the empty condition is the condition that you want to impose, or is it the condition that is always just happens to be true?
Well, if you don't impose it, then you won't get a real solution. So. So continuing with the example where the string is moving perpendicular to the endpoints, how do you relate the velocity in the supergravity to the velocity in the dual gauge theory? So the scaling ambiguity is going to go away, but there's still this factor F for a given R7 that you need to incorporate. And as you increase the velocity, it turns out this for the short string, it'll go closer to the black hole. Whereas for the long string, for increased velocity, it'll go further away from the black hole. And as for the static case, this long string is unstable and should then decay into the short string. And again, these two solutions share the same boundary conditions. So we also considered a steadily moving string that's moving in the direction of the separation. And we found that this isn't a very friendly solution for certain velocities, at least. As you increase the velocity, the cost develops. So we won't look at that solution anymore for this one, other than to say that this indicates the breakdown in the description of the in terms of the Namdo-Goto string action. One would need to include some reference to the discontinuity in this boundary of the cusp.
Could you remind, there was a second paper by MIT group. Where they studied this, you know, screening hot beam or whatever they call it. I don't remember seeing any cusps there.
Yeah, and they actually did this for arbitrary angle theta, and this should arise at one limit. And yeah, as you say, they didn't know it in class.
So they did it wrong, or something? They did something wrong?
I would say so, yeah. I would say they didn't, maybe they didn't do anything wrong, but they missed.
They are a singularity, you think, in their formulas, it depends on the angle, one on singularity.
Right.
Wait, if you just take a static profile for this thing, and there's two ends on it, right, and simply boost it, then you find that these does not satisfy questions of motion.
Well, this is what we get from the equations of motion, but it just means that that's not the complete description of the system.
I think what Pasha is saying, obviously, should satisfy equation of motion, so maybe you're looking at the wrong solution. And also, you know, I would naively expect that if the limit as velocity goes to zero, you know, I don't see why this limit should be so drastic. It could be that you want a sort of wrong branch of the solution.
I would think we're on the same branch of solution. So as the velocity hits, you know, goes past the minimal velocity, the cusp then goes away.
Oh, okay. So that's the cusp rises for the suspicion to the line of velocity.
Right.
Wait, is this Milchitz space length of time?
This is completely time length. So I should say right now and until you know the last part of the talk, everything I'm considering is
so did you look what will be the boosted solution as Pasha suggests?
Well so currently this is going at a velocity.
Right, but if we take a static solution and boost it.
I'm pretty sure it must solve equations.
Of course, because there is a boosting variance.
Well, not on the background, not on the black hole background.
Yeah, but you can boost the black hole.
I see what you mean. So you're saying you have a smooth static solution.
Yeah,
you should be able to boost it so the shape doesn't change.
Yeah. And this thing should solve the equations.
I don't have the answer to that. As to whether this is actually a different branch. I don't know. I mean We it's not like we can really compare, make any like energy comparison or anything between this branch and the boosted branch. So, but whatever the case, there is a branch of solutions that does have this bad behavior. So I guess that's pretty much the point of that slide.
What do you mean by boost?
No, by boost simply means take a string profile. It has some profile, R as a function, X as a function of R. Now you can see that the same solution is replacing by X, by X plus B. So just the same string which moves at constant speed in the bulk of one of the directions.
Okay, so now I'd like to focus on this single quark string that Herzog, Karch, Felton, Kozkas, and Yaffe considered in order to extract the friction coefficient. So this is the case where the string is static. Then it just goes straight down, as they noted, from the prograin and hits the event horizon. But as soon as you try to add some sort of velocity, then it runs into what I guess can only be described as the analog of a ergosphere of a pure black hole. container. So this is, of course, not a inherent property of the black hole. It's just how the string would view the black hole from its reference frame. So above this radius, the string is time-like, and below it, space-like. So it's simply no longer physical. And of course, this radius depends on what the velocity v is. And as v goes to zero, this ergo sphere or ergo thing would coincide with the event horizon. So what's been proposed is that perhaps the solution is a bit different. I won't go into the details of this, which I think have already been discussed last week. But essentially, it turns out that the problem for what happens of signature change can be bypassed for an appropriately chosen integration constant. And so now the string can be purely time-like. And this can enable one then to calculate this friction coefficient, which basically shows how much energy is being pumped into the string endpoint in order to keep it going at constant velocity, and how much energy then is being going off to infinity. So this is actually a semi-infinite string. So that the idea is, this can apply for arbitrary velocity, no matter how small. This is the some sort of stable endpoint of taking a string and boosting it for an infinitely long period of time. So basically, the way this calculation is done is by considering the conserved world sheet current and then equating this with the usual friction force equation, and then using this thermal mass of the quark, they were able to extract the friction coefficient. And for at least for non-relativistic motion, they were able to use the Langevin equation by modeling the system in terms of a stochastic equation that describes white noise. And this assumes that the has to assume that the quark is very heavy. So this seems to only apply for the non-relativistic regime. And they were able to then get the jet quenching parameter, which they noted is remarkably similar to the jet quenching parameter that Leo et al. At MIT calculated. I'll get into that in a bit. But there are some numerical differences. So in order to do this, they use the supergravity time interval. So basically, this scaling function g is going to come into play. So so the friction coefficient and the jet quenching parameter are ways of parameterizing the energy loss of quarks which are moving through the plasma. I have to confess, I didn't have a slide devoted to that since I figured Pavel talked about the stats group.
No.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So,
the jet quenching parameter is not a standard name. It was invented by Liu Rajagopalan.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. I assume that they got that from the perturbative gauge theory work.
Yeah, yeah. But it's called differently. It's called some kinetic coefficient sometimes. But it's not called the jet quenching.
Okay. So basically, it's the rate at which the momentum, the transverse momentum squared, is being lost in terms of the distance traveled by the quark. And in general, it's rather non-trivial to relate this jet quenching parameter, which is what's being measured at rear, to the friction force. which is what Pavel and his collaborators have completed. And this can only be done, so far, in the non-relativistic regime. And, you know, of course, these squawks are really moving at ultra-relativistic speeds. So that's the one of the issues, is how is this prediction of the jet punching parameter going to change as you boost the system up?
At least the Google and company, they computed the jet punching parameter at the speed of light, they forced them to the speed of light.
Right, and we'll get to that complication in a bit. So, yeah, other than maybe I should say again, you know, that the way, the dependence in terms of temperature and coupling constant are the same in both jet punching computations. The difference is numerical. Here you have a 2 pi, and in new Reynolds calculation, you have gamma functions. And I believe if you want to compare numerics, this one is maybe half that. It is a bit smaller than new Reynolds. So one would need to compute to find a way of computing this scaling factor. I would claim before extracting an actual value of this friction coefficient. So there also arises, what is the mechanism of this energy loss? I think that certainly what's been done supplies a possible prescription for getting at the jet, at the friction coefficient. But is this the system that describes what's really happening in the string theory? Namely, as I mentioned, this string, to get at it, basically you've boosted it. It's been traveling for an infinitely long period of time. So where does the energy dissipate to? Well, it just keeps traveling along until the end of space. So is this really what is happening? Or is this an approximation for something else? For example, maybe some more complicated string solution that might be finite and end at the black hole horizon, in which case the energy is dissipated by closed strings. Well, we simply don't know. That's an open question. So now I want to get to this more direct jet punching computation done by MIT group, Liu, Rajagopal, and Wiedemann. And so this is in terms of a Wilson loop, which is used as the non-perturbative definition for the jet punching parameter. And so so the delta t is the time duration, and L is the quark anti-quark separation. So my claim is that in general, this also suffers from the G factor ambiguity, since this computation can be generalized to quarks of arbitrary mass. This ambiguity might go away to limit in the slight up limit that they take when they then take the mass to be infinite.
But I think you are changing the prescription, because for any finite mass, just their prescription doesn't make sense anymore. If you look at the null.
But no, not just because of the null Wilson loop, because, I mean, the definition is in computer Wilson loop, so Wilson loop means you have taken the mass.
No, but which type of Wilson loop? So
a fundamental?
If you have a massive quark, that cannot.
No, for a massive quark, you cannot extract Wilson loop from a string collection.
Yeah, but that's, yeah.
I mean, but if you want Wilson loop, you're forced to do this thing. Because this is.
Yeah, so actually I'm going to talk exactly about how they take this limiting procedure. So since the Wilson loop can be expressed in terms of the Mammen-Grotthus string action, but in order to get a real result, one would have to use either a Euclidean or a space-like streaming solution. So what Liu et al. Do is they use the former space-like solution, and they take the light-like limit of this. And the way they do this is they first put the probe brain beneath this so-called ergosphere. So the string is completely space-like. And as I've drawn it here, there's a couple of possibilities at that point of strings that share the same boundary conditions. Since there's a tending point at the event horizon, but there are also tending points above the probe brain as well. And the way they take the light-like limit is they first take the radius of this ergosphere, quotes ergosphere, up to infinity by taking this v, this velocity v, to 1. And then they take the radius of, the minimal radius of the probe brain up to infinity after. So this is where the quark mass is becoming infinite as well. The weak claim that this limiting procedure is a bit ambiguous, since the results might depend on precisely how one takes these two limits. This isn't to say that it's always ambiguous. There are some cases in which it's not, and we'll see that in a moment. So when we looked at these space-like solutions, we found that there's actually, in principle, infinitely many of them, since the turning point can be down at the horizon. And so A1, for example, is the simplest downstream. Or it can be up above the probe brain. So these C-naught solutions are two examples of this. And there's actually two turning points above the probe brain. And then one can add these configurations together to build infinitely complicated solutions.
So the first two configurations are time-like.
No, so these are all space-like.
But they're above the, or this one, which is the probe
brain,
this is not the...
Yeah, so the ergosphere is above all of this. So it's this A1 solution that was considered by Liu et al. And when they take the light-like limit, this is how they found this non-zero jet punch parameter. Though it's a bit confusing as to why this configuration should have non-zero jet punch parameter when it doesn't have any drag.
But isn't their configuration is the only one that will survive in the limit you described on the previous slide? Isn't the others, it's the bullshit that go above and then at the horizon, wouldn't they have an infinite action in this limit?
When you say survive, you mean the others live just at infinity as you take the limit? And
I get so the way I ask the question is whether the action is finite for the string that goes above and then touches.
Well, yeah. I mean,
I
think that we can still regularize the action in these cases as well. So. Yeah, so we claim that it's the C-naught solution that's the leading contribution to the Wilson. So at every step of the way, taking this limit, you can regularize the action. And after this is done, the action of the C-naught is always less than the A1 action.
Sorry. When you are saying regularize, do you mean something different than just... Well... In their case, when they do the computations, their action is finite, right? I mean, they subtract the self-energy.
Oh, that's true. I'm sorry. You're right. So in Liu et al. Solution, the action is finite. There's still a subtraction of self-energy that is finite, but that's finite as well.
So by regularizing, you just zap something more complicated when you say you regularize.
So actually, the C-naught is also finite, You're right. One can do a similar sort of abstraction of the self-energy, basically to disconnect the strings. And then when you compare, indeed you find that both actions, in some sense, I guess you didn't have to do this subtraction in order to compare the actions. They're already finite.
Well, what about the next grand one? Is that if I subtract self-energy, which is a finite number?
So that depends. I think that would depend on how exactly you take the limit. And this is one way in which the ambiguity of how you take this limit is going to depend. Since, in one way, if one extreme of taking the limit, this second C0 is going to become more and more horizontal, and in the other, the peak is going to become higher and higher.
Still in this order, just as the rate at which they go to infinity is like a different way.
Right. So we focused on this first C0, since this seems to be the favorite solution.
No, wait, I'm slightly confused. So there is gravity in this picture, which in the way it is drawn, it pulls everything down. So if I look at the second, red bump, isn't it
very pleasant? This is what the equations of motion give, which take it back into account. We were actually a bit puzzled by that, or surprised by that.
Okay, so you said any non-zero velocity, and there is no rotation here of anything,
right?
So any non-zero velocity, which you simply force it to make on a straight line, will produce a solution that is bending upwards.
Right.
Let me ask. I think the way how I would think is to do the limit is first we take this. I forgot how you call this. So
I call it a ghost here.
Right. So you take that to the infinity first, mm-hmm. and then you take the mass of the quark to infinity second, mm-hmm. and then in doing so, you the separation between them also goes to infinity in this limit. Is it true that in this case, the only solution that would survive would be lower top solution?
So I think, for example, the C0 solution, this first C0 solution will survive as well.
I think in the first paper you told me they discussed the C0 solution, but they just discovered it.
That was actually a bit different. So forgetting about space-like, if you just go directly to the light-like solutions, then you find that there's a completely horizontal solution. That corresponds to taking that A parameter that you commented on for its integration constant to infinity. You can only do that for light-like. Purely light-like solutions.
Isn't this the same as C0?
No. I mean, it looks awfully horizontal in the scale I drew it, but it's not. There's a small comma.
So the actions they compare is the Euclidean action. So
space-like.
Yeah. So what's the which one has the least action?
So this one over here.
C0.
This first C0 has the least action.
So when you say it's considered non-gravity, so there is no gravity to show?
Well, so it qualitatively, what I mean by that is, as the string is being is moving, so it's something like, let me draw a downstream, for example. And it's moving in a direction that's perpendicular to the separation. So if there was drag, what I mean is that it would be dragged backwards, kind of similar to the solution that Peltel's collaborators considered for the case of a single string. Rather than going straight as it moves, it was dragged backwards. And the way in which it's dragged should correspond to how much energy is being lost.
Yes, so in the single string solution, you're actually pumping in energy at the boundary, so the energy leaks from the string to the other end of the string. But here you have both ends
here presumably you would pump energy in one end and it would go out in the other, without some mechanism of energy loss. One would expect that this Q hat should to be consistent, should be zero as well.
So how did they justify that Q hat is not zero for the solution?
Well, they didn't.
Well, but maybe it's not fascinating, because I mean, after all, their prescription was just this. Just compute the loops and loops.
Yeah.
How do you compute the loops and loops? It's a second question. But as long as you compute the loops and loops properly, what they say is that this gives you good help.
Can we put some argument why that consumption of the limit is related to,
yeah,
yet not clearly understood, that of approximation?
Yeah, so I agree, and one can follow the procedure, but in doing so, I think one has to, you know, see what is the leading contribution. So our thing is that they chose the wrong one, that it's actually this first tsunami. And when you use that, then this yields zero jet friction coverage, which seems more consistent with
how does the loaf of the Newton loop, it's no longer proportional to L squared?
Right. So I mean, there's going to, you know, always be this Coulombic term, this minus 1 over L. And then the correction to that is going to be L cubed for the tsunami case, instead of L squared.
Okay, but the leading one is Coulombic.
Right.
So.
So, in order to get at really, you know, non-zero jet quenching parameter directly in this ultra relativistic case, one would need an alternative solution. So, you know, at this point, one can only conjecture what it would look like. Perhaps, again, it might involve some radiating closed strings. Or it might simply be that, you know, this idea of no drag is a reflection of the fact that this is a quark anti-quark. In Liu et al.'s description, they're using this to actually model the energy loss of a single quark, if you follow the prescription. But you know, really both string endpoints are ending on this prograde. So if you take this to really be a quark anti-quark, then you know it's a color neutral object. And this might simply be the statement that color neutral objects pass through the plasma without seeing it. I would tend to be skeptical, though, of taking these space-like configurations too seriously, since they are space-like. And even in the limit, in the so-called light-like limit, they do remain space-like. So you know, we basically took Liu et al.'s prescription, you know, as a formal prescription, and we wanted to see where it led. But it seems to me that this is simply an unphysical branch of solutions, and perhaps this idea of non-zero jet friction parameter for a configuration that has no drag might be a reflection.
But it's also what they are saying in their discussion is that at least the closest thing they discuss perturbatively is the emission of virtual. I remember some words like virtual gluons, right? Virtual gluons and things like that. So maybe, you know, from this perspective, it's not, you know, it's not a surprise that they end up looking at space like bullshit. I don't know. I wish, you know, there would be a better explanation and they would explain better what they did.
Yeah.
So it's definitely, as you said, it's definitely their interpretation is not the same as your interpretation that they have, that they direct to physical force. I think they would disagree with this.
Well, I mean, on the formal level, the question is how do you compute this and correct it? And you can either compute it through a space-like virtue, or you can compute it through a time-like virtue. Which one of them is correct? So I guess this is.
I think it depends on which question you ask. So if indeed, you know, somehow in the computation, in their way of looking at this jet quenching, it's related to the radiation of virtual gluons, whatever.
No. The radiation of virtual gluons is just, you know, the Riemann
I never understood Wiedemann's, you know, I looked at Wiedemann had lots of discussions of that. I never understood it.
But I think that the virtual, I mean, you always have virtual particles whenever you compute any. So I think that the existence of virtual particles is not directly related to the the logic is case. Like I think it's only because they wanted basically they wanted to convert e to the is to e to the minus s. Yeah. And therefore they took their determinant of reducing it to the I suspect this was the
So in fact, it wasn't clear to us then why they couldn't convert this is to minus s using, for example, a Euclidean configuration rather than spacing. One can carry that through, and then one finds a similar result. That is a downstream that would lead to a jet friction parameter, but it's not the energetically favorable one. And this, as I mentioned, this conclusion is independent of any of these aforementioned ambiguities. So maybe I should also briefly mention, in their first paper, it looked like, you know, as Pavel said, it was a bit, you know, puzzling exactly what steps they were taking. It looked like they were directly considering a light-like configuration. In the second paper, where they considered time-like configurations, they had a footnote 14, I think, where they mentioned that they were actually doing this space-like prescription. And they are apparently preparing a longer explanation for the prescription. So
but apparently, this previous particular prescription claims that it's incorrect. Do they agree with you or you don't know?
Well, we take their procedure, you know, is what it is, and follow it. And what we really think is incorrect is that that they haven't considered the leading contribution to the Wilson. As for the physical interpretation of the procedure, you know, I can mumble some disagreement, but I don't really have anything concrete.
But you're basically claiming that the steps that they described there just doesn't lead to the answer they correctly.
Right. So as for whether they had any reaction to that yet, well, we haven't shown them the paper yet. We're actually planning to.
I think your results that was already in your paper. They were then at least when I looked at your paper first, it was obvious that what you are saying contradicts their claim. So you're saying that they okay. We can.
Yeah, maybe.
I think everything that you said, okay, at least something in your published paper already points out that there is a disagreement.
Okay. Yeah. So maybe I should mention in our first paper, which is already out as a preprint, we claimed that Liu et al. We were confused since there was a square root of g in the action rather than minus g, and so to us that indicated that they used a Euclidean configuration. And so everything we then said, you know, about, you know, that they didn't use the energetically favorable configuration was assuming that it was Euclidean. So then they corresponded with us and said, you know, this was the wrong interpretation. It's actually a space-like configuration. And we should have seen footnote 14 for the second paper. So we then retracted those remarks that their configuration is Euclidean. And now our response is that it turns out that same thing happens for the space-like configuration.
So the correct claim is that if you start with a space-like configuration and you take the light-like limit, then you reproduce the result.
For this non-favorable prescription, yeah. So yeah, so either we need a different string configuration, or else we need a different procedure. So good. This brings me to further directions. So first of all, it looks like there are some ambiguities that need to be resolved before certain quantities can be extracted. From using this ADS-CFT at finite temperature. And in order to resolve these ambiguities, it looks like it's a challenge because it might involve, well, it looks like it has to involve doing some computations at strong coupling. So this brings the question, which string configurations are physical? I think that this isn't entirely clear. For example, with the Pavel and their collaborators, should their prescription be taken as an approximate, the configuration is approximate to what's really going on, this semi-infinite stream, or does it really end at the black hole? Then I think it's still an open question, how exactly is this energy being dissipated? And I of course don't think to know the answer to that, but that is an open question. And so this I've already mentioned. One possibility is that there are corrections to the Nam-Vigoro string action due to the closed string coupling. And this prescription that Lira et al. Proposed for computing the ultra-relativistic jet punching parameter, it seems that I would say at this point that to me that there is no valid prescription.
Wait for a minute. So basically, you have a minimum deep. I said, let's take a certain order of limits between taking velocity to speed of light mm-hmm. and taking your mass to infinity. So the two v goes to one first, and then they take m to infinity second.
Right.
Now, why can't you do otherwise? Take m to infinity first, and then v to one second.
Well, the trouble is, if you do, why do they take v goes to one? Is because they want this ergosphere to go off to infinity, so that when they then take the probe grain off to infinity, the string configuration is always space-like.
Yeah, but right. What I'm saying, why don't you use time-like configuration to
Well, yeah, that's a good question. And then I think you really kind of changed the prescription.
Yeah, sure. So what happens if you do this?
Well, first of all, I would worry about the I in the Wilson loop. If you ignore that, as some people, Chinnikov, Rihosa, and
Garcia,
thanks, have done, then they actually get a similar jet quenching result as Lyrael. However, they do this, again, by using a string configuration that's been shown to be unstable. And if you do that with a stable one, again, you get zero.
Would you instill the same or not the same?
Let me think. It was actually slightly different.
I think it's not the same, but at least
if I take the limit from the time.
What I remember is this. You have these two string configurations, one is stable, one is unstable. If you take the stable configuration, you don't find the L squared dependence in the thing. You find one bar L potential. If you find the unstable configuration, you do find the L squared dependence that they want, but the coefficient there is somewhat different.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
No, but it should be easily the same. Yeah. But what unstable again? So unstable with respect to what?
To small fluctuations. Or an Euclidean to this, which has larger dimension.
So I think this was, a very nice prescription that Pavel and his colleagues in computing the friction coefficient. So then, I would say the challenge still remains in how to relate this to the jet friction parameter in the ultra-relativistic friction. There's also the question, of course, in this whole talk, we've considered n equals 4 super-Young-Mills theory. And really what we'd like to do is consider a more realistic gravity dual. And one example of this Alex pursuit, basically taking a non-extremal version of the Kavanaugh-Strassman solution. Now this non-extremal version is in a perturbative expansion. And I should say that pretty recently, a numerical generalization has come out of this solution. So it might be interesting to apply some of these calculations, or to apply this to some calculations.
That's incorrect.
Oh, that's incorrect.
Yes.
Well, I noticed they basically what they do is they find a non solution that has an event horizon, and it has both 3 flux and 5 flux.
We can talk about this later, but
okay. Do you think the solution itself is incorrect, or the idea that it's a generalization of Fermat-Strasburg's?
Well, we can talk, this is not directly related, but the point is that there is a certain number of parameters you expect in the field theory, and the same number of parameters should show up in the gravity. They have the number of parameters plus some extra number. They have no clue how to fix it. But there is an unambiguous way to fix it.
Of course, we want to find out who said that statement about string theorists. Maybe you guys. So thank you very much.
So are you trying to say that if we take Pavel et al. Description and compute your sort of the fudge factor to go from zero velocity to infinite velocity, we will get the jet quenching parameter for the ultra relativistic friction coefficient?
I don't understand the fudge factor.
I sort of feel there could be something there. I mean, at infinity, so it's a fixed number. It's a fixed number at infinite mass, and it's a fixed number at zero mass. But it could be really some function as you go from infinite mass to zero mass. So it is conceivable.
Yeah, but it isn't. I mean, what is the physical meaning of that? I mean, because if you have a core of finite mass, its position is not going to be finite, right? If you have a core of finite mass, it's really some lump of energy where you have no way to separate energy of the quark from the energy of the medium.
Okay, so then you can interpret it as there is no way of computing the friction coefficient for relativistic for masses of quarks.
Yeah, so to answer your question, I would say yes. You know, my claim is that you first have to compute this fudge factor G. And then there's still the challenge of relating this calculation that Pavel and others did to something that's happening ultra-relativistically. And it's not clear how to do this.
But Pavel, you computed a finite mass, right?
Yeah, friction coefficient, yeah. You can compute a finite mass. Okay. As long as it is above square root of lambda.
Right, and you can compute it actually at any numerical. At least numerically, you can compute it for the value of mass, right? Or no? What's
yes, you can compute it for arbitrary value. First, the question is what mass? Static mass is not the same as dynamic mass.
So I think Justin would say that we don't know how to relate the static mass to the physical.
No, we know how to relate the static mass to the dynamic mass, at least for a moment of the
For large masses.
For large masses.
Right. So, but that's what he's saying. Yes. He doesn't disagree with that, but you know, it looks like that you need to go to an opposite regime in the parameter space.
Further comments, questions?
To the back of the conversation. So different world sheets on the D7 brain, which are all spaced like that you showed in different colors. Is this published or is this?
No, hopefully in the next few days. When we publish, right, on the preprint.
On the preprint. So the MIT group has not seen this argument yet?
No. Mm-hmm. We've been quite anxious for them to see it.
You can say, yeah.
We're going to, yeah. We wanted to, you know, verify everything first and crank out all the kinks.
Okay. No more questions, so it's time to see you again.